CH 910 AM, W245 CT Hayward, and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm Richard Cantu. A new report out of the federal government says homelessness in the U.S. hit an all-time high this year.
The report from the Department of Housing and Urban Development shows an 18% increase in homelessness to a new record of 771,480 people living in shelters, temporary housing, or on the streets. The annual count, based on a nationwide estimate on a single night in January, shows a continued decrease in the number of homeless veterans, but a sharp increase in the number of families living without homes.
ABC's Stephen Portnoy. As the climate warms, the cold is becoming a deadlier threat in the U.S. Harvard Med School researchers found the nation's cold-related mortality rate more than doubled since the late 90s. No mind like the criminal mind. Customs and Border Protection reports seizing more than 20,000 counterfeit Pennsylvania vehicle inspection stickers shipped from Israel to an address in Philadelphia. They're not saying who shipped them or who ordered them. This is ABC News.
I'm James Kelly with WBZH News. Your news roundup in quick podcast form. Find it anytime on the WBZH website at buzzofthenorth.com.
Bucks drop one to the Nets. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with sports. The Bucks lost at home to the Brooklyn Nets, 111-105. Damian Lillard and Giannis both out with what's described as a non-COVID illness. Doc Rivers says the Nets' defense made the difference.
I thought the pressure got to us. I thought we didn't handle it very well. They sped us up. We broke our offense.
The Bucks travel to Chicago to play the Bulls tomorrow night. NFL, Packers holding practice for Sunday's game in Minnesota. Matt LaFleur asked about the status of defensive back Jair Alexander.
Chances of playing this week better than what?
I'd say probably not.
What's standing in the way?
His knee.
Men's college hockey. The Badgers take on Ferris State at 5 o'clock tomorrow night in the holiday faceoff at Fiserv Forum in Milwaukee. Wisconsin 7-10-1 for the season so far.
We'll have our work cut out from us, but for us right now, it's us getting focused for the puck drop, finding a way to get that game in our side of the ledger.
That's the Badgers head coach Mike Hastings. With sports, I'm Mike Clemens.
The Dom Salvia Show.
How about this one? Harvey Kay, a Delano Democrat.
The problem with that is that was his mother's family name. You might not realize that he had a father, too.
Come on, man.
Subscribe to my arguments and you can call a Dom Democrat.
All right, I'll take a Dom Democrat. But Franklin Delano Roosevelt, a big favorite here on this show.
The Dom Salvia Show. Weekdays from 4 till 6 on the Civic Media Radio Network and on the Civic Media app. This is the Buzz of the North, 910 AM WBZH.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here. Today on the big program, lots to get to. Lots to talk about. Michigan. Michigan, oh Michigan. Nice job. The Democrats in Michigan got the keys to the car, and they've been driving it. They've been making lives better, doing smart policies, good stuff. They went back and repealed right to work, you remember, a couple of years ago. Now they've fix their unemployment benefit system, and they are going to expand it through 2027 and beyond, opening up who's eligible, opening up the number of weeks from 20 to 26, increasing the benefit by the time this is done to more than 70% more than it was the increase, increasing the amount per dependent people get so that you can make unemployment insurance something that you can live on for a bit. Something that you can take a breath and maybe be a little judicious in the job that you take and chase. Give you an opportunity to maybe, I don't know, look for the best situation. Also, women in domestic violence situations who leave a job voluntarily, going to open up unemployment for them so that they can get out of abusive relationships and on the... All good stuff. This is all good stuff. And the Michigan Democrats and their governor, you know, have something to run on. And this is what I keep telling my Democratic friends. You got to have something to run on. You got to have something that you've done, accomplished. Something you can go, hey, working people, this is what we do. And this is the message for Democrats overall. Because understand, Republicans aren't going to do anything really to make your lives better. Their argument is, if we make billionaires' lives better, then this magical thing called trickle-down might happen, and your life will get better because of, well, whatever trickles down. Now, I've got red hat friends who say, well, we need rich people. That's how we get jobs. And you go, we need people who organize businesses, absolutely. And we need them to be rewarded, absolutely. But they don't get the whole pie, because what they've organized isn't possible without the labor of people who make their businesses possible. And we used to understand this. And, you know, it's something we talked about yesterday on the program a little bit about the fact that, you know, workers and employers negotiated. They came together. You had a federal government who encouraged collective bargaining because literally the country was being ripped apart. So this idea of sitting down, negotiating in each interest, and then, I don't know, coming to some common ground of how both parties can move forward together. Something that's sane and rational. Something maybe we should try again. Something we're not going to, because again, Republicans have shown us that they're not interested in negotiating. They're not interested in collective bargaining. They're interested in dictatorial power. They're interested in a CEO class who has all the control, all the power, and all the say. And while you worker bees, not so much. Which is why they're going after federal employees. And they keep talking about how they want to go after federal employees. You know, Elon Musk saying there should be no federal unions. You know, those workers should be grateful to us. And the reality is every worker should have a union. I don't care what you do. Every worker should have the protection of a union. And what's interesting to me is that my son came to me and said, you know, I saw this meme, because he just got his first Teamster job, you know, throwing packages at UPS. And he said, you know, I see all this in these memes now, these anti-union memes that now come to my phone and, you know, whatever app he uses. And he says, you know, it's crazy because it's not true. He goes, you know, they keep pushing this frame that everyone's lazy. He goes, I don't see that. He goes, well, what's the argument against it? And I said, well, you know, if you have lazy workers, you got lazy management. Because every workplace, it's the people who manage the employees who get out of them what they need to run their business. If you've got a lazy employee, you've got a lazy management. Because every structure, every contract, every agreement has a way, if someone refuses to work, there's a way to get rid of them. And if you're not following those prescribed rules, if you're not giving the due process necessary to get rid of someone, well, that's your fault. Now, here's the weird thing, and this is what I told him. I said, look, you've worked in other places before. How many lazy workers you see in those non-union places? Oh, yeah, yeah. Because, again, lazy management has nothing to do with union or non-union. Has everything to do with lazy management. And that again... interesting conversation, because we're moving into an era where the Elon Musks of the world are going to be bashing labor unions. So when you see these memes and all of this pre-programmed propaganda from corporate America and the Musks of the world, no, most of it's BS. The vast majority of union workers are well-trained, well-qualified, dedicated, loyal employees who come to work every day and bust their behinds so that they can put food on their table. Yes, they get decent wages. Yes, they get health security. Yes, in many cases, they get retirement security and all of that. And they have job security. Yes, they have those things. And they want everyone to have it. You know who doesn't want them to have it? Republicans. And until a Republican steps forth and say, yeah, we're going to get you the PRO Act. We're going to get you stronger protections for warehouse workers from heat, stronger protections from violence, stronger protections from wage theft. Until I see that happen, all of the rhetoric in the world does not change the fact that Republicans have done everything in their full hearty little heart that they can do to destroy the middle class, working class prosperity that my grandparents' generation built. And it's incumbent on us, you and me, us, to fight for what's ours, the wealth that our labor creates, and also provide an environment for the future so that our children and grandchildren don't have to suffer the same things. Now, understand, these next couple of years, we're going to see the evisceration of the 20th century just about. They're going to go after Medicare. They're going to go after Social Security. They're going to go after what's left of our labor laws. They are going to do this gleefully because they know when they grab that kind of power from us that they then have the control. And as we're hungry and desperate, that's where they know, where they think they're going to profit. So the question becomes, how much will we put up with? How much will we take before we say enough? Want to hear your thoughts? Email me at rick@therickSmithShow.com. Going to take a quick break. When we come back, Michael Sonato from The Guardian U.S. going to be here to share some thoughts.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors, the American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
I tell you, I love the Democrats in Michigan. They got power to do things, and they move the agenda along. Maybe the states are where we're going to have to spend a lot of time making things better. Michigan being one of those. Granted, Trump won Michigan, but you know, ultimately, Democrats still control the House and the governor's mansion there. It's still the House and the Senate. They have the ability to make lives better and going to have to start doing that at the state level because we know nationally things not going to look good. That's why I've asked our good friend Michael Sonato to come talk with us. Michael's a labor reporter at The Guardian U.S. Where he focuses on labor issues. And, well, going to be an interesting 4 years. Michael, thanks for taking time for us.
Thanks for having me on again, Rick.
So, you know, I look at what they did in Michigan, and they're obviously waiting for the governor's signature, which I'm told that she's going to sign. You know, Democrats, when they get the keys to the car, don't seem to drive it in a way that does the things that we want them to do. Except Michigan, man, I got to tell you, the last couple of years they've been killing it.
Yeah, absolutely. Especially with all the issues with unemployment benefits during the pandemic when so many people, needed it. And a lot of criticisms from Republicans and the far right was criticizing it as entitlement, the whole it's keeping, people from returning to work, all those claims. So kind of bringing those benefits and updating those in many states, they're very low. They're very just outdated, underfunded. They vary widely from state to state. So to see a bill like this that improves those benefits and kind of, provides reforms to, actually help people for losing jobs at no fault of their own. Yep. I think is really, really important and will have a big impact on people's lives in Michigan. And that's what, the Democrats need to start doing, at the state levels where they have the power to do so.
Yeah. And look, it gives them, something to run on. Gives them something to say, hey, look what we did to help working people. Look, we're really the party of workers. Look what we've done. And there's not an awful lot of that, especially at the federal level, where the federal minimum wage hasn't been raised. And at this point, I can't even do the math anymore. 15, 16 years? I don't even remember. But it's been so long that I don't remember. But states are doing it. And come the beginning of the year, there will be a number of states that raise the minimum wage, some by automatic cost of living adjustments and others by statute. What are we looking at in the new year on the minimum wage front?
you know, like, you know, most years, you know, in January is when these minimum wage increases, you know, start off. Even in Republican states where Trump has won, you know, Trump won Michigan, you know, Missouri passed the $15 minimum wage. That's a red state. You know, where I live in Florida, the voters voted to approve a wage increase to $15 an hour. So those are clear policies that help people. And, you know, we know that the federal minimum wage hasn't been, you know, raised since 2009, but, you know, that fight also hasn't existed. You know, just looking back on Kamala Harris's campaign, she supported raising the minimum wage, but would not put out a number. And kind of, you know, what does that tell people? That tells people you're not serious about it. And, you know, Democrats at state levels need to kind of, you know, actually learn from what just happened in November and, you know, enact policies and fight and push back and not, you know, cede or be afraid of, you know, criticism from industry groups or you know, the opposition, that, you know, get into the fight rather than running away from it.
Yeah, and while I agree with that, I got to tell you, though, you know, Donald Trump didn't come out with anything. In fact, will not move to raise the minimum wage, and Republicans have been hell-bent on never raising the minimum wage because they still hold on to this this fallacy that it's a job killer, that if we raise the minimum wage, you know, all those poor low-wage workers, they're going to all be out of work. And yet, is that the case?
No, there is a study a couple months ago from the Economic Policy Institute citing all the research on all those, you know, minimum wage laws, you know, where the common refrain from opposition is this is going to cause job losses. And in all those cases, that doesn't happen. We've seen it over and over. We saw it in California with the fast food workers, you know, raising their minimum wage to $20 an hour. In January, the minimum wage is raising to $16.50 an hour. And, you know, the you know, largest economy in the U.S. It's just, you know, ridiculous fear mongering in opposition from industry groups. But, you know, when you look at, you know, actual research, actual data, it's not true.
But, you know, I've got friends in California who tell me there are no hamburgers around. They've closed all the ice cream shops, all the hamburger joints. It's all gone because of that dreaded minimum wage. And they can't find anything.
Yeah.
Other than one on every freaking corner.
Absolutely. Yeah. All those talking points didn't happen, you know, and that's, you know, the case in all, you know, every state that's raised the minimum wage, all these minimum wage fights, you hear the same, you know, fear mongering and concerns, you know, when the fact of the matter is that's, you know, not what happens.
Yep.
You know, yeah, there are some, you know, economic balances in between it. But the fact of the matter is that these companies, these, you know, employers who are relying on low wage workforces are making money hand over foot, like, you know, Walmart, Dollar General, all these like multi-billion-dollar companies. So, I think it really just serves those interests. And it's just circumventing, you know, an actual defense of those profits for, you know, fear mongering.
Yeah.
So I think that's what it does.
No, and look, you know, while you can point to, you know, Democrats not doing enough, you have to point to Republicans who are doing a lot and nothing to help working people. And we're heading into another Trump administration where I do believe the bullseye is on the back of everyday working people, even though there seems to be this frame out there that, you know, Republicans have had a change of heart. I know it's the Grinch season and all that. I don't see their heart growing three sizes to help working people. But what are you expecting in the new year from the new administration and the people that they have put into key spots?
I'm expecting an anti-worker, anti-union administration. You know, especially with Elon Musk, you know, he was tweeting today that public employee unions shouldn't exist. You know, Trump's nominee for labor secretary is one of the you know, few Republicans who co-sponsored the PRO Act, but you know, her voting record doesn't suggest one that coincides and supports workers. You know, this week the National Labor Relations Board chair missed being run nominated because of Senators Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema, and that's ceding the majority of the board over to the Trump administration, their picks, and the impact of that. Not only are, you know, all the good policies that we've seen, like, you know, just recently banning captive audience meetings held by employers, I could expect those to be rolled back, but I also expect, you know, new bad policies to come out of the Trump administration. You know, we've been, you know, covering and talking about Project 2025. Nothing in these policies is helping the average worker, and things like tariffs, you know, fighting unions, it's just going to make things, you know, more expensive and hurt people who are already struggling to make ends meet.
No, as I've been saying, look, the solutions will come out of the suffering due to their savagery, and we're gonna have some struggles. We're gonna have a lot of that. And a big part of that also going to be on the environmental front, on the worker safety front. And you've got a piece out recently on, you know, coal miners with black lung disease. And, you know, you start and think about, you know, putting another mine, you know, mine CEO in charge of MSHA. You talk about the CEOs taking over our government and this deregulation fetish and destroying the administrative state fetish that the right has. It doesn't make for a good recipe for working people.
No. And you know, under the Biden administration, they passed like a silica dust rule finally. You know, and black lung has been increasing because coal miners are, you know, getting in, you know, deeper in mines. So what they're mining is, you know, just more toxic. They're getting into more silica dust rather than just the coal. You know, so those are big issues. The heat standard issue, the Trump administration is expected not to pursue that. That was going to take, you know, at least another year to get while it was being proposed through the rulemaking process. All those things with OSHA, on top of, you know, we can anticipate further underfunding these agencies. Whether it's through these safety agencies or the regulatory agencies, or just not replacing people who, you know, leave after the Biden administration, which was, you know, we saw in the first Trump administration. So it's, you know, really, you know, opening up the floodgates for employers to do whatever they want. And we saw under Trump, you know, injuries and, you know, worker fatalities, you know, increase, and while like enforcement actions were just not happening, certainly not at the level that we've seen under the Biden administration, like, you know, child labor violations that we've seen over the last few years.
Yeah, and we can expect more of the bad stuff and less of the oversight. And, you know, I brought up the black lung thing, and you brought up the fact that we're digging deeper, getting further into what's left of coal in this country. It's only going to get worse for miners. It's only going to get more dangerous. It's only going to get more deadly. And to have less oversight and less regulation is only going to harm these people even more. And these are folks who these are the Trump folks.
Yeah, which is you know, unfortunate. But I'd also like to, you know, I'm speaking with coal miners who are, you know, Democrats too. So, you know, I think the conservatives, Republicans have tried to, and they've done a good job in framing their, you know, bulwark supporters as, you know, the blue collar working man. But, know, what can the left do to counter that? You know,
is, well, I think pointing out a big part of what kind of dangers that they're allowing to happen, and the fact that they're not making lives better. One of the things that I've been saying, Michael, is that, look, I'm glad you're telling me there are Democratic leaning miners out there who are going to be in those spaces going, hey, look around us. This is what's going to happen to us. Pointing out the realities of what Trump and his CEO billionaire class government is going to bring us. I think that's really, really important.
No, absolutely. And, you know, we've seen throughout American history when those regulations and safety regulations are ignored in dangerous jobs like that, that it causes, you know, injuries to workers, worker deaths, and you know, oftentimes those employers, you know, there was the West Virginia coal miner owner who only served a year in jail, and then he was back trying to run for Senate and governor and everything. It's a big issue that already, you know, these workers are facing huge risks. So to go into administration, we're at the federal policy, the federal level, the Trump administration, their interest is getting rid of all of that, not in enforcing what already exists and throwing out what's been, you know, in the rulemaking process and getting worked on, you know, for years. It's not only going to have an immediate effect, but it's going to, you know, further, you know, push back all those efforts that have been, you know, workers, unions, worker advocates, experts on, you know, safety regulations have been pushing for and working towards, you know, for years.
We'll see where this takes us. Finally, I got to get your thoughts on the Albertson Kroger deal that evidently they've terminated their bid to merge these two companies, a $25 billion merger plan. And now you've got Albertson suing Kroger over the claims that Kroger failed to sell off assets that would have gained them clearance. Kroger clearly, obviously says, no, that's crazy. So we've got another lawsuit. But in this moment, the merger not going to happen, and I think that's a good thing for the workers in both arenas.
It's good for the workers, you know. It's good for consumers, you know, who, you know, we've all been experiencing high prices at the grocery store, and you know, we just know from data and research that corporate concentration causes prices to go up. So that was one of the big fears about if this merger was going to go through. And, you know, we saw from Albertsons and Kroger, they were saying that if this merger doesn't happen, then jobs are going to be at stake. And Albertsons, you know, changed their tune. They don't have that, you know, in their announcement of pulling off the merger. They didn't have that, but they are going after Kroger. So it seems like recompense for both of them for, you know, what they've been trying to push. They spent, you know, $1 billion trying to push this merger through despite opposition from, you know, UFCW locals who represent thousands of workers in Kroger and Albertson's grocery stores. And just, you know, for people to know, those are the parent companies, but, you know, they own numerous types of grocery stores. Right. So if you see one brand, it might not be that specific brand isolated on itself. It might be part of, you know, Kroger or Albertsons or another, you know, grocery conglomerate. So, you know, corporate concentration has had, I did a couple of weeks ago a story on, you know, the impact corporate concentration has had on grocery prices just recently, compared to inflation. You know, basic necessities have significantly increased far beyond inflation. Yep. You know, we saw the Kroger executive admit that they were raising prices beyond inflation. This is a good thing, you know, given
Now, look, they could have spent that $1 billion on lowering prices instead of wasting it on trying to merge under the ideology of if we don't merge, we'll fail, that we have to get bigger in order to compete, which generally I believe is nonsense. And we should be using our antitrust laws to break up too big to fail instead of saying, hey, the only way we can continue is if we get too big to fail. I'm glad to see this went down. That simple. Michael, I appreciate the time as always. I hope you have a great holiday. Keep up the great work. One of my favorite labor reporters out there. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Rick.
Michael Sonato, labor reporter there at The Guardian US. Make sure you check out the work that he does. I want to hear your thoughts. Do you think, you know, breaking up the big this big merger is a good thing? Do you think it would have brought prices down if we let them get even bigger? And if you believe that, I got bridges. I got lots of bridges to sell. Quick break, right back.
You're listening to WBZH, Hayward's home for the Todd Allball Show.
Enjoying this local program?
Find the complete Civic Media lineup at civicmedia.us or the Civic Media app.
I'm meteorologist Mace Michaels. Cloudy sky tonight with areas of rain, maybe a little mixed snow, foggy, and lows in the mid-30s. A rain and snow mix through tomorrow morning, mostly cloudy into the afternoon, highs in the upper 30s. And mostly cloudy Sunday, foggy, and upper 30s again. It's 39 right now.
The Todd Allbaugh Show.
UW Systems spends $51 million of our taxpayer money for consultants. Three times the budget shortfall that triggered the Oshkosh layoffs in 2023. Why is there such silence from Democrats in the state capitol on this? Ask people in Richland Center, Waukesha, Washington County, if they got their $51 million worth for the UW system.
The Todd Allbaugh Show, weekdays noon till 2 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So one of the things we've been talking about for the last couple of weeks is, you know, what our Supreme Court is going to do in the new year. Also, this NLRA case, you know, what happens to the National Labor Relations Act if it gets to the Supreme Court? Do we have a court that, well, does as they've been doing, overturn decades of decided law, maybe create new law all on their own? I don't know. That's why I've asked our resident expert, so to speak, one of my good friends, Ian Millhiser. He's a senior correspondent over at Vox. He is also the author of How a Republican Supreme Court is Reshaping America. I think we can change that to how they've reshaped it. But Ian, thanks for taking time for us.
It's good to be here. Thanks so much, Rick.
You know, I remember reading that book years ago and going, man, this would be terrible. And yet, well, here we are.
Yeah. No, I mean, what we have seen, and I mean, this is what I predicted in the book, is that the court is aggrandizing as much power within itself as it possibly can. You know, and there's a simple reason for this. You know, the presidency changes hands all the time. It's about to change hands again. And so, if you are Republican and you want to make sure that Republican policies are in place all the time, you can't count on the presidency. Right. You know, sometimes the president will be a Republican, sometimes it won't be. And so the Supreme Court has been taking a lot of power that historically has belonged to Congress or the White House and has been moving it into itself because there's a 6-3 Republican majority on the Supreme Court. And the GOP is likely to keep that for, you know, probably for the rest of my life, at least.
And potentially expand it during the next 4 years. I mean, you know, who knows what happens with Sonia Sotomayor? She's not getting any younger or any healthier. Who knows?
Yeah, no, Sotomayor, I mean, she's. I mean, everything I've heard is that she's very healthy. I've seen her at public appearances, and she looks great. But she's also 70, and she's a type 1 diabetic. And, you know, nature sometimes happens, and yeah. I just hope it doesn't happen to her in the next 4 years.
I'm right there with you, because look, there's a lot of bad potential in this next term and in the next year. And I wanted to get some of your thoughts on what you're paying attention to, and maybe what we should be watching out for and what's coming down the pike. I know there's a transgender case that's making its way through. I know this thing with Doge Boy and Bezos with the NLRA is going working around. Yeah. What are you paying attention to?
So the trans case, I mean, let's start with that, since that's the biggest news out of the Supreme Court in the last couple weeks or so. I am really worried about how the oral argument went in that case. And I'm worried because, not just because I think the court is going to reach a ruling that is very bad for transgender people, but there's a lot of ways. The specific issue in this case is whether states are allowed to ban certain kinds of transgender healthcare, hormone blockers, or rather puberty blockers, hormones, things like that for transgender youth. There's lots of ways the court could uphold that. That's at least limits the damage to transgender people. And, you know, I think that would be a terrible outcome, but at least it would cabin the outcome somewhat. What I got from the oral argument, though, is that the court seems inclined to create kind of a medical exception to the constitutional ban on gender discrimination broadly. So not just, you know, discrimination against someone who's transgender, but, you know, just someone is fired for being a woman, or like they create a medical exemption. You know, imagine that a state were to say that like men can have one drug, but women can't, or like men have priority in an emergency room, or like, you know, imagine that there was a state law that just had a different policy regarding how doctors should treat men and women. The way that things work now is anything that treats men differently than women or women differently than men has to get a certain amount of heightened scrutiny from the courts. It's not that it's always struck down, but the court just take a close look and be like, well, wait a second, like we're against sexism here. Let's make sure that you have a legitimate reason for doing that. And what the Supreme Court seems likely to do is say that it's no longer going to give that extra review to sex discrimination that occurs in the context of healthcare or medicine.
And that would be it sounds like a really bad thing.
It would be a terrible thing. I mean, it would be a terrible thing because, you know, again, like sex isn't bad. Discrimination is discrimination. And whether it happens in the healthcare context or elsewhere, it is currently illegal in many contexts, and it should remain illegal. But it's also bad because once the Supreme Court starts creating carve-outs to the rules against discrimination, you know, what's next? Yeah. You know, are they going to say there are other contexts besides medicine where the rules don't apply? Are they going to create carve outs for the ban on race discrimination? You know, like the way that the court is supposed to work is that it's supposed to follow the law consistently in every single case. It's that consistency that is just a central part. I mean, that is what the rule of law is. The idea is that no matter who the party is, and no matter what the issue is, you apply the same law every time. And the court seems inclined to say, nah, we don't want to do that anymore.
No, and that makes sense from a lot of the other things. As a layperson looking at what the court does, it seems like there doesn't seem to be a lot of consistency outside of, you know, whatever the moneyed interests seem to want, the moneyed interests get.
Yeah, I mean, like, unfortunately, one thing that I've learned since I attended law school, you know, I went to law school, and like, I guess when I got there, I was really naive, and I thought like, well, you know, when there's a legal dispute, there's got to be a book somewhere that tells you what the law is, and you just look up the rule in that book, and then you follow the rule. And what I have since learned is that much of what the law is just a bunch of arguments that you can make. And when you're a lawyer arguing a case, you make the best argument that you can come up with. And then the judges will frequently just pick the outcome they want. And, you know, it matters if you have a good lawyer. A more persuasive lawyer is more likely to persuade the judge. But I've just learned that the law is much less predictable than I used to think it was, and that so much depends on who the judges are.
No, and sadly, I don't disagree with you. I used to think, we had some stability. We had, but it seems maybe not as much. And I look at labor law. You know, I thought we decided a lot of this stuff, and we've been talking about this for years. And now, what, 1935, the NLRA is passed, and here we are, you know, 2025, potentially going to overturn it. Something that's been decided for, 90 years? Seriously?
Yeah, I mean, there's a case making its way up. It's in the Fifth Circuit now, which is the most right wing of the federal appeals courts. And like you said, I mean, it's not just that the NLRB and the NLRA have been around since the Roosevelt administration. It's that, you know, there was a huge consequential fight. I mean, like when you're in law school and you read the history of constitutional law, one of the most important cases you read, the case that basically began the modern era of like Congress's ability to regulate the national economy, is the decision upholding the National Labor Relations Act. It is one of the most important turning points in American constitutional law. And so the idea that 90 years after that fight, all of a sudden, like Elon Musk or whoever, Elon Musk's lawyers, has come up with some bold new theory that invalidates everything that's happened in labor law for the last 90 years. I mean, come on. Like, how could you possibly make it clearer that this isn't about what the law says? It's about who the judges are. They think they have a Supreme Court now that's going to let them get away with stuff that they haven't been able to get away with for nearly a century.
Right. Now, again, you and I have talked extensively over the years about the Lochner era and the Lochner court. And I know conservative lawyers who believe that was wrongly decided. And I'd probably argue there are probably six people on the Supreme Court right now who think that was wrongly decided. And they probably believe they're there maybe to undo a lot that's been done since there. So this being part of that.
So the Lochner era briefly is like there was this era in mostly the early 20th century where the Supreme Court struck down all sorts of labor laws and other like progressive economic legislation that the conservatives of that era didn't like. So, the minimum wage was struck down in this era. The laws giving people the right to unionize were struck
child labor laws.
Yeah.
Maximum hour laws, all that.
Yeah. And then about 90 years ago, in 1937, the Supreme Court said that, that's a mistake. We want Congress to be able to decide what our labor policy is. It shouldn't be our business to decide it. And that's been the rule again since 1937. And I guess what I have to say to the people who want to go back is, if the last 90 years had been bad for the United States, like, if you could look back at the last 90 years of America's economic history and say, man, we really screwed the pooch when we started letting Congress pass labor laws, like things just went off a cliff once that happened, then maybe you could make an argument for going back and undoing all this. But like my understanding of U.S. history is that the latter two thirds of the 20th century were pretty good for the United States of America. We became the wealthiest nation in the history of money and the most powerful nation on earth. We have prospered in a way that our great grandparents could not possibly have imagined since the Supreme Court made that choice in 1937. And so I don't understand why we would abandon a system that has served us very well and replace it with the system that served our great-grandparents terribly.
Well, I would argue that the people who don't know about it don't know what it is or why it is or how it is. But the people who do know understand that a massive power shift like that would come in an enormous redistribution of wealth from the people who don't know about it, well, to them.
Yeah, no, and I mean, I just think a lot of these really conservative, like libertarian Republican thinkers, they just don't understand economics. Like, you can be some rich guy who's making some great product and making a lot of money on it. You know why you're making a lot of money off of it? Because people can buy your product.
Yep.
And if you eliminate the rules that say that, like, workers have to be paid enough that they can buy things, if you eliminate the rules that give them bargaining power, if you eliminate the rules that mean that they, like, get time off so that they have leisure that they can use to buy things that one uses when one has leisure, eventually what happens is just the whole economy dries up. You can't have an economy without consumers. And the only way you get consumers is, unless you're talking about the handful of people who have, like, family wealth or something. The only way you get consumers is that people earn money through labor.
Yeah. I got to get your thoughts on the most recent, episode of Christian Cinema what's that guy from West Virginia? I'm hoping to forget about
Joe Manchin,
soon.
Yeah.
That I'm hoping to forget about both of them when they leave the Senate. They both voted no to move a procedural vote to get Chairman McFerrin reconfirmed as the chairwoman of the NLRB, kind of a final screw you to the Democrats. When we were talking off camera, you had mentioned maybe this is a silver lining somewhat. Walk me through the thinking on that.
Yeah. I mean, it's a very thin silver lining. Like, this is not a good development. So, like, the background here, the NLRB has five people on it. And the NLRB, the National Labor Relations Board, is the board that enforces basically all of U.S. labor law. Like, you know, if your union has a dispute with your employer, it is the NLRB that is going to, you know, step in and adjudicate that dispute if it rises to the level where you're actually filing legal complaints. And the way that the law is set up is essentially the majority, with the party that controls the White House typically gets three seats on the NLRB. The party that does not control the White House typically gets two seats on the NLRB. But the members serve a term of a certain years, and Biden was trying to essentially reappoint one of his members so that Democrats would maintain their three-seat majority for the first 2 years of the Trump administration.
Right. And that's been done by in the past as well, right?
Yeah, that's normally the way that it works is that outgoing presidents fill all the vacancies they can. And then when the vacancies open, the new president. So like Trump was going to get a majority on the NLRB eventually.
Right.
But we were talking about two more years where you had a National Labor Relations Board that was actually going to protect the interests of unions and union members. That's not going to happen because, you know, so like Trump will get into office, he'll get to fill the third seat, and we will have a Republican NLRB from that point forward. The one small silver lining I can see here, and it is the thinnest silver lining, but the one silver lining is I brought up this Fifth Circuit case that is claiming that the NLRB is unconstitutional. And what might happen is that once Republicans gain control of the NLRB, they can just do what Elon wants them to do anyway. You know, they can moot the case by doing the thing that the plaintiffs wish would happen anyway. And that will at least save us from the possibility of a Supreme Court decision striking down the NLRB. And then, you know, we never get labor rights back potentially. But it's not a good development. I would much rather roll the dice on a world where there's two more years of an NLRB that's going to protect unions and protect union members than like, you know, say, well, yay, maybe they'll do the wrong thing for Elon Musk and that'll have downstream consequences because some case is mooted.
Yeah, well, let me ask you, what would stop them from moving the case? If he got what he wanted, the NLRB just threw it out and he got what he wanted, couldn't that case go forward to get a decision anyway? Or is it moot because there's nothing to pursue? Because I see them going, we got what we wanted on the short term, but we still got the long game of ensuring that we get the decision. Or is that not possible?
Yeah. I mean, you're right that like, you know, the silver lining here is even thinner than I initially described it because like the rules governing mootness are actually kind of complicated. And like the general rule is that if you're engaged in a lawsuit against someone, there has to be some kind of real dispute there. So like if the person you're suing wants to give you the thing that you're asking for, generally, that's just not the court's business. But, you know, there are exceptions to that. The other thing is that even if the NLRB were to like, if this case were somehow to be mooted, it's like there's labor disputes happen all the time. Like someone else is going to file a lawsuit right. against the NLRB. They're going to raise the exact same arguments. And, you know, I don't see any way to avoid this showdown.
All right. So last question I've got for you. Obviously, the new year is going to bring new and interesting challenges. I've been asking people this all week. What are you watching for? What's the issue that Ian Millhiser is paying most attention to?
Oh, God. I'm paying attention to a lot of things. I mean, I want to know how serious Trump is about retribution. You know, is he really going to start bringing political prosecutions against people? For that matter, is he going to bring a political prosecution against me? You know, I don't think that I'm particularly high on the list. But like, you know, do journalists have to be afraid? And like, there is something about being afraid of your own safety that crystallizes the mind and makes it hard to focus on other issues.
No.
But I will bring up one other legal issue that I think is going to come up in fairly short order, and that is regarding Trump's tariffs. So in the Biden administration, the Supreme Court built out this kind of fake legal doctrine called the Major Questions Doctrine, which said that essentially if a presidential administration tries to do something that's too ambitious, the Supreme Court will strike it down. They had never applied this thing before Joe Biden became president. It doesn't have any grounding in the Constitution. They just sort of made it up. But if the rule is that a presidential administration can't do things that are too ambitious, you know, putting in place like a 10 or 20% tariff on all goods, or like, you know, some of the other tariff ideas that Trump has floated, strikes me as really ambitious. And so if you take what the Supreme Court said seriously in those major questions cases, I think the Supreme Court should strike down the tariffs. Now, will they do it? I don't know. You know, we're one, you know, like the broader question that I want to find out here is, will this Republican Supreme Court apply the rules that it made up to, you know, to handcuff Joe Biden in a fair-minded way and also apply the same rules to Donald Trump? Or are these rules only in place when a Democrat is president?
Yeah, I think we already know the answer to that, but we'll see. I mean, that's why we play the game. We'll see how this plays out. But just for the record, if you hear of me falling out of a fifth floor window, I didn't do it on purpose.
Yep, no, it's Russia all around, it seems.
Ian, I appreciate the time. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Rick.
Our good friend Ian Millhiser. Make sure you check out his work over at Vox. Also, make sure you check out the book. And it's one of those things, it's a look back for history. It's a look back to, I can't believe how right he was. But make sure you check out The Agenda, How a Republican Supreme Court is Reshaping America by Ian Millhiser. Going to take a quick break. Right back. Stick around. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1971. That was the day that Namibian workers began a general strike to protest the contract labor system. As a colony of South Africa until 1990, Namibia faced many of the same apartheid-like measures that blacks faced in South Africa. Black migrant workers in Namibia comprised the majority of workers in the diamond mines, fisheries, and commercial farms. They were forced to live in the northern third of the country and were subjected to the pass system. The pass system determined where they could live and work and when they could travel. Restrictions on their rights as workers were directly tied to restrictions they experienced as colonial subjects. Because there were no trade unions at the time, this strike is considered to be an important first step in the 20-year fight for independence. More than 13,500 black contract workers participated, effectively shutting down 23 key workplaces and 11 mines. The indigenous Ovambo and Kavango workers demanded the right to choose jobs and contracts to bring their families to distant work locations, a new pass system, and increased wages based on work type, not skin color. In her book, Labor and Democracy in Namibia, Gretchen Bauer says that while workers did win wage increases, the pass system remained largely intact. Employers were angry that workers now had the right to bid on jobs, quit at will, and receive holiday bonuses and leave pay. Workers were upset that they were still subjected to restrictions of movement and arbitrary arrest and detention. But the strike began the long process of eroding the pass system, contract labor, and second-class citizenship for the indigenous workers of Namibia.
Labor History in Two, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
Listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
2025 is interesting, going to be a really interesting year. Got to tell you, going to show you who we are. And while there's talk of Republicans wanting to stand up for working people, you know, as I mentioned with Ian, you had Kyrsten Sinema and Joe Manchin, both conservative corporate Democrats, I would argue, who have... Sinema made that weird kind of U-turn somehow to become a Manchin-type Democrat. Both of them voted against reconfirming the nomination of Lauren McFarren, who could have been the head of the NLRB for the next 5 years, would have given the Democrats control of the NLRB for the next two. They chose not to. And there are no Republicans that came to the rescue. And for all of the rhetoric that we hear, and we hear a lot of people saying, you know, the Republicans are going to be the party of working people. We hear the guy from Indiana, this Jim Banks, saying, well, Republicans need to be more union friendly. Yeah, there's all this rhetoric, all this talk. Roger Marshall, who, you know, Teamsters president Sean O'Brien touted as one of the good ones. Where was he? He didn't vote. So we've created this environment where there's rhetoric, lots of rhetoric, no action. Will the future bring us action? I don't know. But what I know right now is what I see. And that's a Republican Party standing in direct opposition to working people. It just is what it is. And we'll see what happens when Trump appoints his people to the board and to be general counsel of the NLRB. We'll see what their background is and how bad that's going to hurt. But overall, understand, and I think Ian made an extremely important point. It doesn't matter who's in the White House anymore because the Supreme Court has already decided the path of the country. And that is going to be a very corporate, very conservative-esque kind of direction. Laws aren't going to matter anymore because they've consolidated power in the Supreme Court, and we're going to return to the bad old days. There are people that I've met throughout the years who are dead set against the idea of the Lochner era ending, believing the case was wrong, the case that overthrew it was wrongly decided. They believe in liberty of contract or freedom of contract, as I keep hearing now, where if you're hungry enough, desperate enough to work for poverty wages in deplorable condition, that is your freedom. If your family's poor enough to push your kids into the mills and the farms and the factories, that's your freedom. And the reality is it's not, but it's what's being pitched. And, you know, as we talk about this stuff and as I share, you know, this kind of information with people, they don't believe it's our history. You know, generations fought to end child labor violations, fought for children to be able to get an education and have a childhood. Generations fought for a minimum wage, a minimum standard of living. People fought for maximum hour laws to ensure a life-work balance. All that stuff's up in the air. All that stuff is now on the table to be decimated. And this is what we were talking about during the campaign. And I know everyone, well, Donald Trump wouldn't do that. No, Donald Trump's people will. The people that he has put into place already have done enough damage, and it's only going to get worse. So look, the next 2-4 years, it's going to be all about pointing out the horrible stuff that they do and how it affects us. And how much more it is going to affect us, and how much pain and suffering is going to be derived from their bad policies. They are going to overturn virtually everything Biden did. You know, I had someone ask me the other day, well, what happens to all that pension money that I had a Teamster. This is the amazing part about it. I had a fellow Teamster wearing a red hat, now concerned about his pension after voting for Trump. Heard me say, everything's going to get probably overturned. And if the money ain't out the door, it might not get out the door. Now, after his vote was cast, now concerned, well, what about my pension? Well, don't ask me. I think Donald Trump's the guy you should be asking about. What are you going to do with the rest of that pension money? Because does it get out into the funds to ensure that retirees get the benefits that they were promised? Or, sorry, buddy, better luck next lifetime. These are the stakes. And now you got Doge Boy running around talking about gutting Medicaid and all of that. The future is going to be, well, interesting. And out of this comes opportunity. And look, I'm optimistic like I've never been before. Because I do have faith in the American people. I have faith in us to wake up and to stand together. And when that happens, and it will happen, when that happens, the Supreme Court is one of those places that have to be addressed. Unquestioningly, undoubtedly, has to be addressed. But we'll see what the next year brings us. I want to hear your thoughts. What are you paying attention to? Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. I'll miss any portion of the program. Make sure you grab the podcast. Check out freespeech.org for our videos. And as always, I appreciate you being here. And your input. We'll see you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com.
This is the Buzz of the North. WBZH 910 AM. W245 CT Hayward. And always streaming on the Civic Media app.
ABC News. I'm Richard Cantu. President-elect Trump throwing a potential lifeline to TikTok. He's petitioning the Supreme Court.
2 weeks before the high court hears oral argument over TikTok's future, the president-elect urges the justices to delay the January 19th deadline for a sale. His attorney says in the filing that Trump opposes a ban of the immensely popular app and hopes to work out a negotiated resolution that would save it. The Biden administration and key congressional leaders argue that while it's owned by a China-based company, TikTok poses a national security threat, serving as a potential propaganda and surveillance tool for Beijing.
ABC Stephen Portnoy. A court in southern China wasted no time sentencing a man to death for plowing his car into a crowd of people in Zhuhai in November, killing 35 people. His family and CBS announced the death from cancer of longtime sportscaster Greg Gumbel. For 50 years, he did sports of all kinds. Greg Gumbel was 78. This is ABC News.